This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Picture a 5 or 6 year old boy, who many said was undersized for his age, getting kicked in the stomach by a 5 foot 8 tall, 300 pound grown woman.
These are the written words of Ohio inmate number 45699, Jason Campbell.
As you would expect, it dropped me to my hands and knees. I couldn't breathe.
They're taken from a letter that he wrote to us in February 2019.
I was constantly in fear. All of us kids in that house were.
I'm Ned Parker, and Jason Campbell is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Zoe Hines and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary producers.
These letters are graphic in detail and describe real true crime events as told directly from the last person to see their victims alive.
Mayville 911.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 4, Becoming a Killer.
May 2019. I'm in the US, where I've been for a couple of weeks filming. I'm currently sat in a crumbling hotel outside a crumbling town somewhere in Ohio. I'm in my room sipping tepid coffee from a styrofoam cup, waiting for 9 p.m. to come round so I can call back to the UK for an after-school FaceTime with my sons. I've been feeling guilty about not having called home more frequently on this trip. But today, there's a real urgency in my need to speak with my children and to tell them I love them. The reason for this is because earlier in the day, I'd sat down with a convicted murderer. And although I had prepared myself for hearing an awful story of his crime, one that had seen this man sent to death row, I somehow hadn't been totally prepared for his accounts of how horrific his life had been up until that point. A childhood in which he'd been starved, beaten, and even set on fire by his parents. Childhood abuse is something we encounter with tragic regularity when we communicate with convicted murderers. And of course, such experiences, no matter how awful, can never be used as an excuse for murder. But when I listen firsthand to the sheer depravity involved in some inmates' childhoods, it's impossible not to find myself asking, how is this ever going to end well?
Before we get started on this episode, we'd like to take a moment to say thank you for joining us on this journey. Thanks for all the 5-star reviews so far. And if you haven't already, then please do give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. And do share the episodes with your network on social media. Your support means a lot to us.
In this episode, our letter writer is Jason Campbell, who, at the time of recording, is currently serving 2 life sentences for murder in the state of Ohio. There was a moment after reading this letter when we started looking into the details of the case that we stumbled across an incredible coincidence in the story. And it was on the basis of that that we knew that we had to investigate further.
From the thousands of letters we've received from inmates on death row, this case really sticks out.
It is a really incredible twist of fate that meant that Campbell wasn't even a suspect in this murder for over 5 months. And you'll hear that twist in our case file in just a moment.
Jason Campbell doesn't detail the events of the murder in his letters to us. Instead, he takes the time to tell us about his upbringing, which is why our theme for this episode is Becoming a Killer.
As filmmakers dealing with the stories of murderers, one of the biggest questions we're asked is, how does someone become a killer? In the case of Jason Campbell, there's a possibility of a brooding inclination for violence in him, but there's also abuse from his adoptive parents, which might possibly have led him to that position. Or maybe it was a lack of a role model or a lack of stability in his life. These are all themes that we're going to be looking at in this episode.
But before we look at Campbell's letters, let's hear the details of the case and of that incredible twist that led to him evading capture.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official press reports and court documents. In February 2003... Jason Campbell was incarcerated in the Warren County Correctional Center in Ohio. a minimum security facility where he was due to serve 2 years for car theft. But he wasn't going to stay inside for long. Just weeks after being detained, Campbell and another inmate climbed the prison fence and escaped. Cold and desperate for cash, Campbell found the back door of a house unlocked and went inside to explore. When the residents awoke to find Campbell standing over their bed, a violent struggle ensued. Campbell struck out and slashed 55-year-old Helen Riley's throat. He stabbed her multiple times. He then overpowered and strangled to death her 44-year-old husband, Donald. Campbell took some clothes, $20, and went to a nearby bar to drink. Later that night, he returned to his slain victim's house and slept in the spare room while the Rileys lay dead in the room next door. The following morning, Campbell hitchhiked to Florida, where he remained undetected for months. How did Campbell manage to evade capture? Because no one was looking for him. In an extraordinary twist, Campbell wasn't the only murderer on the block that night. Just doors away, a man was stabbed and beaten to death by his former employee. That employee was Donald Ketterer. Despite denying murdering the Rileys, police immediately linked the cases. Ketterer went to prison with the death penalty. Campbell got away with murder.
Let's talk about the bizarre coincidence here. Three murders, two attacks, one street, one night. Completely independent occurrences.
It is the kind of story that a fictional crime writer would come up with. When the police found these dead bodies, they, I guess, understandably thought that the murders must be linked, that they were the result of a killing spree. So when they managed to connect one of the killings to Donald Ketterer, as a result of that, they also assumed that Ketterer must have committed the other two murders on the same street that night.
For me, as soon as you hear that they didn't look for a second murderer, you're into discussions of investigative tunnel vision, and the phrase we're all getting used to hearing these days, or at least I am, confirmation bias.
For those of us who don't know, can you explain for us what exactly tunnel vision and confirmation bias are?
Tunnel vision is the reluctance to consider alternative possibilities, which often comes about subconsciously. But in terms of law enforcement, it comes about as a result of confirmation bias. What are the chances that these are two isolated incidents? They're both stabbings, they're both domestic scenarios, they're in the same 24 hours, in the same neighbourhood. Why complicate what seems absolutely obvious? Every piece of evidence that supports this theory is suddenly going to fit a preconceived idea of what's happened here. And, as a result, outlying possibilities, theories, evidence that doesn't quite fit, in this case, the chance of a second killer, finds itself pushed to the bottom of the pile. They have a murderer literally caught red-handed. He was caught wearing yellow gloves with blood on them. And the logical extension of that is that the murder that happened 0.1 miles down the road was committed by the same person. It's a sliding doors moment and it's fascinating.
We didn't know any of this at the time that we first started writing to Campbell and when we started getting letters back from him, which made this a really intriguing case to then explore.
Let's hear some extracts from the letters themselves. Quotes from Campbell's letter are read by an actor, but these are his words, as written to us from prison.
I guess that my biggest concern is that I won't have the option to pull back, should I not like the way things are going. Perhaps I am worried that you have a particular method by which you produce your shows.
Initially, he's concerned about how he's going to be represented if we select him to feature in our Netflix documentary series, I Am a Killer.
My brother has told me that you utilize prison guards and other prisoners who know the individual the show was spotlighting to talk about him or her. My brother told me that it seemed as though the individuals selected were clearly not fans of the prisoner, and even went so far as to say he got the distinct impression that there were clearly people who had reason to dislike the prisoner. Guards assaulted by the prisoner or prisoners in a rival gang.
As he explains his concerns, Campbell also reveals information that will become crucial to us in our attempts to secure access to him and his story. He claims to have been involved in one of the most violent episodes in an Ohio prison since the infamous Lucasville riots, which had occurred there almost 30 years before.
My real problem lies in that in 2008, I had an incident at this prison wherein I assaulted several prison guards and put four of them in the hospital. They sent two of them by medevac helicopters and others by ambulance. It was the most violent incident upon guards by a prisoner on record, at least since the riot which occurred here in 1993, and saw the rape of one male guard and the murder of another. It is 11 years later, and I still take flack over it. From this brief description, you can see that I wonder if you will be able to find any unbiased guards to speak with about me, should that be your plan.
I personally thought it was fascinating that Campbell volunteered that information at this point. He got ahead of the curve. He knew that if we started going down the road of looking into his case, this was very likely something that was going to be flagged early on. As a filmmaker, that kind of candour is definitely an indicator that Campbell's going to potentially be open to talking about other things. But it's certainly interesting that he's put this very violent, very incendiary incident on a platter and said, here, look, I'm giving you my opinion on this thing that happened.
He's worked out that it's better to tell us first and to put everything bad on the table as opposed to let us discover it afterwards.
It showed a consciousness, it showed a self-awareness, but at the same time, it's betrayed this complete lack of self-awareness because he hasn't taken this opportunity to talk about the thing he's been asked about, which is taking another person's life. After calming his concerns about our documentary research methods, Campbell then begins to open up, and he writes us a long letter about his upbringing. It's like the lid's come off. He's got permission to talk to us, and it's really sad.
I was told I was fond of brooding. I only remember being left to my own devices most of the time, and therefore found things to occupy myself with. Many times, I was not allowed to go outside, so I would invent games to play in my head, or watch dust motes and sunbeams, and try to guess which one would hit the ground first. I distinctly remember only one thing from my earliest days among my adoptive family, and that was, from the very beginning, I was punched and kicked and beaten by my adoptive mother at every turn. Whenever no other adults were around, she would find some trumped-up reason to assault me. Even if someone were just in the other room, which was often the case with my adoptive father, she would essentially recruit me into helping her hide the abuse from others, particularly my adopted father.
Campbell continues to talk at length about his adoptive mother and seems to suggest that he became desensitized to pain as a result of being abused from a young age.
Picture a 5 or 6 year old boy who many said was undersized for his age, getting kicked in the stomach by a 5 foot 8 tall, 350 pound grown woman. As you would expect, it dropped me to my hands and knees. I couldn't breathe. Most kids can specifically remember the first time they had the wind knocked out of them. It is usually in conjunction with some kind of sports activity. Hell, it is scary and painful, so you tend to remember it. My first time is no less memorable, painful or scary, but didn't come with a jovial tale that inevitably follows. About getting up and dusting oneself off, and jumping back on the proverbial horse.
At this point, we have to begin to ask ourselves, was Campbell trying to get us, as the readers of his letters, to draw a connection between his experiences as an abused child and his subsequent life choices that would eventually lead to him becoming a killer?
I was constantly in fear. Honestly, all of us kids in that house were. But my siblings all agreed, years later, that I had been her favorite punching bag. So I played into the role sometimes. She had threatened to kill me on several occasions, and even held a knife to my throat at one point in an attempt to get my adoptive sister to admit some minor infraction. That instance was weird for me, although, if I really think about it, it was normal. For her. I can distinctly remember trying to protect my little biological sister from her violent tendencies. I would often see her beginning to go off on my sister, and I would instinctively do something that I knew, in retrospect, would transfer her anger to me.
An aspect that's a constant struggle for us as filmmakers is how do you validate the truth of the letters that we receive? There are, of course, pretty extensive methods that we can use to cross-check and confirm various aspects of the truth. But when you receive a letter such as Campbell's, you can't help but empathise with the tragedy of his upbringing. It's important to note here that even if only some of his claims are true, this was a horrific situation for any child to have been in. And it seems to me he's very clear in his mind that his background was a reason for him being in the situation that led him to murder and led him to a jail cell in Ohio. This is something that we have come across consistently and continually in the stories we've looked at, not just in the films that we've made, but the thousands of stories that we've considered making films about.
This is the narrative that he wants to tell us. If you step back from it and look at what he's writing and the order that he's writing these details in, it is very much a victim narrative.
With those cases that we've covered when child abuse has existed, we look into it very carefully and we are extremely careful about what we present on screen.
There's no denying that this is his truth. And part of the process of developing that into a film would be to try and get closer to an objective truth. Not to undermine what he said, but to corroborate by investigating alternative perspectives, speaking to people that he's mentioned, but also to Child Protective Services, perhaps, people who would have offered us a different perspective on Campbell's upbringing and what he went through.
Some of the cases that we've covered in our Netflix series, I'm a Killer, and in other series that we've produced, we do see this kind of abuse pretty regularly. And I remember just a couple of years ago, I interviewed a psychologist called Michael Gelbert, who told me, just because you've been exposed to this sort of childhood, it doesn't mean that you're going to become a killer. It just makes it easier for someone to fall off the edge. So even without Campbell here telling us any of the incidents of the murder that he's committed, you can already start to see where it's come from. And I think that's particularly interesting.
Let's return now to Campbell's letters. He continues to tell the story of his upbringing and seems to be setting this up as the catalyst for his violent actions.
I was with my adoptive family till I was 9 years old. My sister was, unfortunately, stuck there until she was 15. And I sometimes feel that I abandoned her. And honestly, I think she may feel the same. As in, after I left, there was no one to protect her. And she was inevitably the one to take that evil woman's violent outbursts. From the ages of 9 to 17, I was a ward of the state. This had a lot to do with my inability to adjust to the free-falling I had. Once I was out of my adoptive family's house, I'd lived in fear for nearly 7 years there, and it all went away once I got taken from them.
Campbell talks about being a ward of the state here. Over the course of our research, we discovered that he'd been passed between 27 different care homes, and claimed that he'd experienced similar abuses in the system to those that he'd been through at home.
I lost any fear altogether of anyone or anything. I felt invincible and made a vow to myself that I would never let anyone make me that afraid again. So, anytime I felt as though there was a niggling of fear developing, I would assault them.
Campbell seems to be suggesting that he's gaining confidence in his ability to defend himself, but by using the same violent actions that he grew up being a victim of.
I ended up with a lot of criminal assault charges as a juvenile. I wanted so desperately to have the normal life that I saw so many other kids getting. I always found it to be some kind of conspiracy of unfairness that occurred for me to end up with my adoptive family instead of some loving family that would treat me well. I mean, I always saw all these photos and videos where some unfortunate kid gets adopted by a sweet, caring family who gives them their life their birth parents could not.
As his letters continue, Campbell begins to take on a dispassionate tone, but then he writes a sentence that we found truly shocking.
I always thought that my adoptive mother would kill me, so I never set up any plans or goals for the future.
I never set up any plans or goals for the future is just such a heartbreaking phrase. He probably does feel like the world is against him. And he's telling us this awful, awful story of his abusive childhood. But on the one hand, you've got him saying, I was beaten, I never made plans for the future, I thought I was going to die. And then he uses phrases like conspiracy of unfairness. I'm sure that this is just the way he's packaged it up in his head. But for me, it does leave you as a reader feeling a little bit emotionally confused. You want to feel for him, but conspiracy of unfairness complicates your sympathy. He seems to be suggesting the world was plotting against him personally and forgetting he's not the only person to suffer. In fact, he's caused immense suffering for others.
Just the use of the phrase conspiracy of unfairness and the way that he writes shows that he is very literate. He's not unintelligent by any measure. And you can tell from his writing that he's eloquent in the way that he phrases things. It's almost poetic in some instances. But his crime, remember, was to break into someone's house and to commit murder. Why would someone who has that sort of innate intelligence commit an act of such kind of senseless brutality? It raises questions. And I'm no longer sure if I can trust the narrative of the story that I'm being told. Perhaps he's learned to write more poetically during his time in prison, and maybe he's showing evidence that he can be highly manipulative. Maybe he's even manipulating us in these letters. I don't know, but it makes me a little unsettled, but it also makes me intrigued. And when we first received these letters, I do remember that it just made me want to learn more.
We've said it ourselves many times, and it's been said to us, not everyone abused becomes a killer. But almost all of the murderers that we hear from do seem to have experienced some form of abuse in their lives.
In the years that we've been doing this, everything that I have seen only reinforces that connection between difficult, traumatic childhoods and violent crime. It's unquestionable. Let's put the theme that we've been discussing about what it is that makes someone become a killer to one side and return for a moment to the other element of the story that caught our attention, which is, for want of a better word, the narrative twist.
I remember the moment when I found out that another murder had happened just down the road from the one that Campbell committed on that very same night.
When we were looking further into his case, one of our researchers brought forward this twist and said, look, he wasn't arrested for 5 months on the basis that the police had already believed that they caught the killer because there was another murder committed on the same street, on the same night, in the same town. I mean, that is just a really dramatic story.
Let's remind ourselves of what happened on that evening in February 2003.
Letters from a killer. Case file. After breaking out of a minimum security facility, cold and desperate for money, Campbell found the back door of a house unlocked and went inside. A violent struggle ensued, resulting in the murder of the homeowners. But that wasn't the only murder committed on that street that night. Just 500 yards away, Donald Ketterer was arriving at his employer's house, where he was intending to extract $200 from him to help pay a court fine. The employer, Lawrence Sanders, refused to pay up. Ketterer responded aggressively. He struck him 3 times in the head with an iron skillet before stabbing him 9 times and viciously assaulting him with forks and scissors. Ketterer stole Sanders' Pontiac and approximately $70 in cash. A pathologist concluded that the 85-year-old Sanders had died of multiple traumatic injuries. Ketterer was wrongly accused of the murder of Helen and Donald Riley and was sentenced to the death penalty, while Campbell evaded capture for 5 months.
So what a story. Before we get to the verdict on this case, let's just wrap up the twist by explaining how complex telling these kind of stories can be.
As we continued to make our investigations into the Campbell case, it was because of his former violent acts towards prison guards that the Ohio Department of Corrections told us that they were refusing us access to interview him. But we had also made inquiries to reach out to Donald Ketterer, but initially he didn't respond.
However, even if we had got the go-ahead to tell one of either Campbell or Ketterer's stories in a documentary film, Ketterer's conviction had a direct impact on Campbell's apprehension. So both stories were intricately linked to the extent that I don't think we could have done one story justice without telling the other.
Until we could secure access to both persons of interest, essentially both the stories were out of reach to us. But I suppose in a way, that's an interesting part of the story in and of itself.
Letters from a killer. The verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents.
Taking into account his horrific childhood, and despite the death penalty being legal in the state, an Ohio jury recommended that Jason Campbell should instead spend the rest of his life behind bars, but without the possibility of parole.
Campbell received 2 life sentences, but the jury did reject the recommendation of death.
Campbell himself read a statement in court after his sentencing.
I can't forgive myself, and probably never will.
He then went on to describe how he saw his last moments on Earth.
They will probably come and tell me it's time. They will ask me how I am. I'll say I'm fine. I probably won't be remembered for anything I've said. If I am, let it be that I'm sorry for what I did.
It seems that the mitigating circumstances of Campbell's background, as identified in his letters to us, have come into play there, especially if a recommendation of death was rejected. Sentencing in America is treated as a different stage of the trial to guilt or innocence. So they would have found him guilty, and then they would have moved on to a sentencing section of the trial where the prosecutor would have recommended death and the defence would have argued, don't put this man to death, and used his childhood trauma as mitigating circumstances.
So in the end, the circumstances of Campbell's childhood and his background did come to the fore, because it was on that basis that the jury decided that he shouldn't be executed.
A psychologist actually testified that Campbell was psychologically damaged permanently by the age of 11 and argued that he was a psychopath. So that would suggest that he doesn't have the same empathetic comprehension as the rest of us. He can't perceive the world, perceive the consequences of his actions the same way as a normal person might.
And they're equating that to his childhood, saying that he had become a psychopath. Not that he was born a psychopath, but that his experience and his childhood traumas had led to him becoming a psychopath. And I think that makes Jason Campbell's case all the more intriguing.
In this episode of Letters from a Killer, we've explored the letters of Jason Campbell, who raises a question that we constantly ask ourselves. What causes someone to become a killer? Is it a terrible upbringing?
Many times, I was not allowed to go outside, so I would invent games to play in my head.
Is it being passed from foster home to foster home?
From the ages of 9 to 17, I was a ward of the state.
Is it some sense that you need to fight back after suffering years of abuse?
Anytime I felt as though there was a niggling of fear developing, I would assault them.
Or is it simply that split-second moment when a decision is made to act and to lash out at your victim?
Without talking to Campbell, we can have no idea whether he made a connection between the abuse that he experienced as a child and the violent crime he ended up committing. But we certainly know from our experience that some inmates do recognise new truths and connections in their broader story when they go through the process of writing these letters to us.
In this podcast, we've posed ourselves a really big question. What is it that leads someone to become a killer? We're not psychologists, we're not criminologists, we're not social workers, and we're certainly not going to be able to get to the bottom of that in a 30-minute podcast. But I do think that by looking at the letters that Campbell has written to us, where he explains where he's come from and the traumatic challenges that he has faced in his childhood, it poses enough questions for us to start assessing what might have been. And I think as long as we keep asking ourselves these kinds of questions about these possible connections, then I think that we're at the beginning of being able to better understand them and maybe getting closer to finding an answer.
Next time on Letters from a Killer. Accidental homicide.
I did kidnap her. Did take her money. I am not guilty of intentionally killing her, and they knew it. I was not a cold, bloody murderer, as they made me out to be. Her death was an accident.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker, and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.